Welcome home. We are WNST, Towson Baltimore and Baltimore Positive. I hope you're cranking us up out on the AM dial and setting a dial. Mine's at number six for AM 1570. You can sit at anywhere you want. Set your dial for the 23rd. The Cheatstros come to town. We'll be down at Fadley's with our friends from the Maryland Lottery, giving away the Gold Rush Sevens Doublers. Also, our friends at Liberty Pure Solutions, keeping our water crystal clear. I'm drinking my water out of the orange-colored glass these days. Also, our friends at Jiffy Lube MultiCare, keeping cars on the road, including Luke Jones out in Owings Mills for training camp, fake football, real baseball. And this guy is at the intersection of all of that as the longtime columnist and one of my mentors in life and at the Baltimore Sun and in great writings. He is unearthed a treasure trove of Orioles memories and old school stories that lots of folks are checking out and talking about on a sort of weekly basis. I don't know how many he's had out, which is why I'm bringing him back. He is our defending champion and author of all things Iron Man and horse racing books and football books on race and quarterbacks and all sorts of things. I don't know what his next project is, but he's bird taping. We welcome John Eisenberg back onto the program. The good professor. Of all things, what's going on, man? How are bird tapes going on? You picked a heck of a summer to find that box of tapes, John.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not going to lie. Part of my calculus, I don't think I'd be doing this if they were losing 110 games a year. And you have to gin up a lot of enthusiasm. But, I knew there was some interest. The team looked pretty good. The team has been good. So that's good. People are into the Orioles. They're excited. And I have this stuff going on. And I've heard from a lot of people that, thanks for doing this. Honestly, they're saying it's adding to my interest in baseball this summer. And good. I'm glad to hear it. I mean, it's a fair amount of work on this side, but I'm enjoying it, to be honest with you. And we'll just keep it rolling.
You know, I've chronicled the recent history of Oriole baseball, not nearly as glorious or illustrious. Interesting. I mean, Peter was interesting in many, many ways. But your documents are the history of how all this got laid, really before Camden Yards was built to some degree, right?
Yeah, it's a collection of tapes that was in my shoebox that in a closet that I collected when I was doing my oral history of the Orioles, a book. That book came out in 2001, so 23 years ago. A lot of these interviews I did a year and a half before that while I was researching. So 1999, 25 years ago. So, but that's when it stops. Yeah, so Camden Yards was what, 92? So it's the whole Memorial Stadium era and then the first 6 or 7 years of Camden Yards. And that's where I stop with this.
Well, let's pimp the book first and foremost, because the book still sort of stands on its own, is some sort of transcript of what you heard in kind of, in their own words was sort of the subject matter and the style that you took to tell that story 25 years ago. I saw the Cal Ripken squirting people on his anniversary and your book wound up in the little video vignette that your stuff shows up on the top of my timeline of Facebook. Zuckerberg must know our algorithm together, but the book itself, speak about that a little bit, because that would be an entryway for me in as much as the tapes are a little bit more backstage, probably more rich history. The book at the time, I'm sure you're still very proud of that storytelling part of it's still a great gift, right?
There it is. Yep. The book is, it's called From 33rd Street to Camden Yards. This is my copy that I'm using as I work on this stuff. And yeah, no, as far as I know, I mean, there's been a lot of books written about the Orioles, some good books. This is the only one that I'm aware of that is an oral history. That is, this book was in the words of the people for the most part. It's a lot of long quotes from people talking about various things in history and sometimes disagreeing and arguing, and with written parts by me to keep the narrative going. It's the only time I've ever done that. And I've written 11 books. It's the only oral history I've done. And it was a really interesting experience. You learn a lot. Such as not to get too highfalutin here, but what is the nature of truth? Because a lot of people have different memories of the same event.
And, well, my friend John Miller, not the John Miller, the broadcaster, the Wall Street Journal John Miller, just finished a book on Earl Weaver. And I would ask you at this point, Because I remember Weaver, you know, tipsy at banquets, getting pissed at Palmer, tops in sport. I was at the paper when all that was going on in the 80s, when Palmer was trying to make a comeback and Earl Weaver was doing baseball on TV. And that relationship in your book, where is that? Because of all the relationships in the history of Oriole baseball before Cal, let's say, and Cal had his own relationship with Earl too. But the Earl Jim Palmer thing really sort of Jim won a World Series before Earl got here. You could probably tell him that. Probably did on various occasions.
Oh, he definitely did. Definitely.
But that really is, there's a real protagonist antagonist part of their relationship through the ages that my father found interesting as fodder in 1978, 79. That I think if you were an Oriole fan at any point, even before you got to the paper, really, that's really where the juices, it for me, is hearing those stories.
The stories are Earl, as I roll these tapes out, and also in the book, Earl is, of course, he's pretty close to the main character, because everybody's got a story about him, and he was just around for so long and such a prominent role and so great at what he did, but also flawed and just all of the above. I'm in touch with John Miller. I'm looking forward to his book because I think he's got some stuff in there that really hasn't been reported a whole lot before. And I think it's going to be a really good book on Earl. And he's right to zero in on him as such a fascinating figure, really for a major biography.
Well, and there's nobody in your box of tapes that didn't talk about Earl. Nobody.
Nobody. Nobody. They're all talking about Earl. They all have these stories. I mean, Ken Singleton, who I just put up a couple of days ago, just hilarious talking about Earl, you know, that he said he was just obnoxious. You know, when I was playing, I mean, he was just loud. He said, I'm quoting him, loud and profane. And he got in the way and the umps were mad at us. And as a result, we were playing against the umps. He said he came to appreciate him more later. And I think Palmer, to go back to what you were discussing, had the same sort of approach. I mean, they just battled over pitching and who was in control when Palmer was on the mound and all these things. But if you listen to the Palmer interview, he said, you know, the reason I'm in the Hall of Fame is that what year was it? He had 25 complete games. One of those years in the 70s. He says, Earl
78,
just
maybe 75, 78. So, oh, go ahead. Yeah.
Said Earl he just let me out there. He just left me out there. He had faith in me to win the ball game. I didn't always win. I won a lot, but sometimes I lost. But, you know, it wasn't like today where they're warming up in the fifth inning and, oh, let's get the starter out of there. It's like, here's our pitcher, win or lose. And he was really good. And as a result, he won a lot more games. He won a ton of games. And so he's in the Hall of Fame. And he says, really, I owe it to Earl. And he's aware that obviously they were oil and water, or just two sort of innately smart guys battling over who's smarter. But, it was a productive relationship.
John Eisenberg is here. He's five times the author I am, at least, and has written many, many books over his shoulders. So, John, I've written a couple books. And I Purple Rain 1 now is 24 years old. And I'd have to go back and read it again and read all my quotes from Trent Dilfer and the late, great Tony Siragusa now. We're losing people. Jacoby Jones, we lost him from the second Super Bowl. So you go back and you get these stories. I wonder if I went back and wrote it again or read through the tapes, did I leave anything good out? Oh. And I would think for you to go back and do this all these years later, because you felt like you put the best stuff in the book. I don't know if you felt like, that's not really flattering about Earl. I'm not going to put that in the book, even though Singleton said it and it was on the or whatever. Whatever would be said, flattering or not flattering about anybody in that era, that I'm sure there are things on the tape that you thought, my better angels, that it's not. What have you found that you went back 25 years later and thought, well, that could have been in the book or should have been in the book, or hey, it's been 25 years, we might as well tell the truth now, because I'm sure there were some things people told you that didn't make it in the book that were just sort of like, here's a little bit of color for it. Because as journalists, we do that. But now you find this stuff years later and the tapes sort of, did you edit? You haven't edited the tapes. The tapes are pretty.
They're edited. They're unfiltered. They are unfiltered. However, I am upholding the whatever parameters the subject set on. Like, for instance, I've got Frank Cashin coming next week. Had a great sit down with him. Truly a piece of Baltimore baseball history. his story. And he said some stuff that was off the record. And he said, this is off the record. You're going to have to fight it from someone else. A lot of it had to be, a lot of it involved the sale of the Orioles when Hofberger sold them. He says, this is off the record. So I took it out. And there were, it's funny. What was it? Who was it that told me? It was Earl that told me that the whole point with Mike Cuellar, when they got him by trade in 1968, he was in a terrible way in his marriage. His first wife had run up huge credit card debt, and they were in the process of getting a divorce, and he was all messed up in the head, according to Earl. And he says, that's off the record. You can't use that. And so I took it out. And then I'm listening. Harry Dalton tells the whole story in his interview, and none of it's off the record. So I put it in. So it's you know, I'm just being honest with what these people said. And yeah, a couple of people have said to me, boy, I tell you, Mike Cuellar's ex-wife. I mean, you know, I'd like to hear more about her. And I'm like, sorry, that's all I got. I'm sorry. But
well, it is amazing in the modern era that some of that would be dragged out on Instagram or this or that or problems or, you know, the crazy stuff Earl Thomas was doing a couple of years, just whatever that would be. But in that era, guys, alcohol problems, financial problems, they didn't make a lot of money. I mean, really, I mean, against what guys are making now, they make a lot of money, still have financial problems. But like all of those behind the scenes things that reporters who wrote on trains or things would have known about guys off the field, whatever that off the field thing would be, or how management feels about the heart of a player or their behaviors, that's a whole different thing that we talk about more now, especially on draft weekend in the NFL, right?
For sure. And a lot of stories went unreported back then. And for instance, one, my Frank Robinson interview, and this story has since come out, but this was in 1999. You know, I was saying to him, do you think, we talked a lot about race. And I was like, well, is Baltimore ready for a black player, a black star Oriole? And he goes, he pauses, he goes, you talking about the team or the city? And, you know, I said, well, you tell me. And he says, you know, he talked about how trying to find housing in 1966, this is on the tape, that his wife, he was in spring training, his wife was trying to find housing up here. And he said, everything was fine until they found out that Mrs. Robinson wasn't Mrs. Brooks Robinson. You know, it was, you know, and they were denied housing, and Jerry Hofberger had to step in. Frank was ready to walk away. And, he said that, you know, it was not a good situation. The what was going on when he first got here. And he says, I'm not even sure the team was really ready. They had been in existence for how long? And yeah, they've had a few black players, and but they had not really had, star players like a lot of those teams in the National League, which that's well known in baseball history. The National League integrated a lot quicker than the American League. And so, you know, he's sort of circumspect about all of that. And I wish that I had explored that with him a lot more. I mean, I had too much ground to cover. The problem was I had him for about an hour and a half at an Arizona Fall League game. And I had to ask him so many questions, trying to get all the important things that he'd done. So I moved on. And
time here was short against the balance of Oriole baseball. And significant, but short. And he had an exit. Not unlike Eddie Murray, just we're done with you. That Cal and Brooks never had that kind of exit.
That's correct. And Frank Cashin tells me the story in this interview. He says Frank understood that he had to go. He was 36 years old. It's a thread. That's a thread. The departure of Frank Robinson is a story that runs through, because Paul Blair told me that was a major, major setback. He said, and it had a lot of it had to do with the DH. I mean, they dumped him after the 71 season. By 73, there was a DH. He would have been a great DH. And
they went and got Tommy Davis, as I remember it.
Yeah. Right. And they could have had Frank, who was 36 or 37. Maybe it was the right move.
Frank was managing the Indians 2 years later, right?
Yeah, literally. Absolutely. So it's just an interesting, it's an interesting perspective that certainly deserves airing and is really interesting when you consider Baltimore baseball history.
Also his greatness. I mean, just in general, that he came back as a GM, came back as a manager, you know, he ran baseball's policing for years, all of that, like all that part that Frank's a rich part of. John Eisenberg is our guest. Tell everybody where to find the tapes and all that. And then I want to take a dive back into Hofberger, because I think that's important.
Yes, the this project is it's Baltimore, you know, Orioles history. It's available at birdtapes.substack.com. Substack is a media platform where a lot of sort of independent writers like myself at this point, they become publishers and put up whatever you want to put up. Some things develop quite a following. I'm pleased to report Substack has announced that Bird Tapes is a bestseller in the, on their platform. So birdtapes.substack.com. And I'm putting up some free posts, some paid posts, and just rolling through it here as the season goes on.
John Eisenberg is our guest. He writes great books. If you see a guy that looks like John Eisenberg hanging out on York Road, it's because he's still here doing his thing. And you got a book in the works or anything happening or no?
Nothing right now. This has been fairly all-consuming, the Bird Tapes. It's about the level of time and energy investment that I want right now, and it's a lot of feedback and a lot of fun. So I'm just going to roll with it a little bit longer. No books at this point.
I think what I try to do, it's my 26th anniversary. I got to get rid of my 25th anniversary cupcake here this week, is we're doing 26 oysters in 26 days and 26
Oh.
ways in September to celebrate the end of baseball season, beginning of football season, and a month with an R, and a couple of oyster festivals as well. I would just say this, the Rubenstein thing is its own thing, and people are asking me if I'm getting my press credential back. Nah, I don't think. Yeah, I don't. I'll be writing about that on Labor Day, but I don't think that'll be happening. But nonetheless, the change of ownership and the deodorizing of all of the Angelo sins, and they've got Cal squirting now and Ruben Splash, and he's dancing on the dugout and giving away free hats. And I don't know what our level of expectation of ownership is, but the Hoffberger thing, as it was told to me, and the reason I'm and Aparicio in Baltimore, not very much unlike what Frank Robinson went through. I had a cousin that didn't speak the language, but was a star player and sold a lot of tickets, and everyone loved little Louie, and he couldn't get along with Vec. All of that was perceived as being a problem child in Chicago, and then came back because he could help him sell tickets and was a champion after coming here. But Hoffberger and Aparicio, you know, if I Louie's still alive, and if I were to talk to him, I would ask him about that. And about Hoffberger and how things were different then. And I'm not asking Rubenstein or Angelos or Eli Jacobs or anyone to be like Hoffberger, but Hoffberger was a pretty special cat, as I understand it. And you got some off the record this and cash and that and all that. Tell me what you know about Hoffberger if you were to write a long chapter just about him.
Well, a lot of stuff on the record too about Hoffberger, and most of it's off on the record. And yeah, I had all those players had stories, and it's very interesting to talk to them. Boog Powell, he loved the fact that when they came back from road trips, there was a case of beer sitting in his locker. You know, he said now that was a value added to his contract. Hoffberger was a beer guy, and Boog appreciated that a lot. And they all liked Jerry. He came out of the beer business, brewery business. He ran the brewery for the whole time he was running the Orioles as well. And he, I think, was by nature a family guy and a good guy. Now they all did have contract negotiations with whoever it may be, Lee McPhail or then Frank Cashin. And those didn't always go great. And that generation of player didn't make a lot of money and they got screwed. And, you know, if they walked in with an agent, they got kicked out. And
But I've
it
also
was.
seen the empty stands that make me
Yes.
think like he probably wasn't getting rich off the baseball team in the way
No.
that we started to perceive the Yankees and the Phillies and the Dodgers in the late 70s when we started seeing Don Baylor and Doug DeCinces and all those players go and play in those places. Before there was media money, there was just the eyeball test of I saw Vida Blue pitching against Jim Palmer in 71 in front of 3,800 people,
Right.
at Memorial Stadium. I'm like, tickets were 75 cents. They had no sponsors. They had no television. Where did the money come from? No wonder Brooks Robinson got screwed, you know?
Well, Cashin talks about that in the interview. He talks about how Edward Bennett Williams, who wound up buying the team, and he tells the story of the sale and how EBW wound up owning the team. He says, "Yeah, you got to give him credit. He brought the fans here. He figured out how to do it." The start of attendance and EBW, there were some definitely some negatives to him as an owner. He did win a World Series. He also sort of oversaw the beginning of the drying up of the scouting and development pipeline, which became a major problem.
Were you at the press conference when he called his manager a cement head?
No,
You don't remember that one?
Altobelli.
He called Altobelli a cement head. Yeah. I'm just a little Oriole history here 40 years later as I'm remembering it.
Well, he didn't, you know, he was a smart guy and he didn't necessarily respect a lot of these baseball guys. I don't know that he had a lot of respect for Cal Ripken Sr., you know, fired him six games into a season and wasn't sure that he was the brightest guy. And so, you know, these guys that had put their whole lives into making the Orioles good, it was a little rough. But he did figure out how to start filling up those stands. And that was Jerry. The really interesting stuff I got on Jerry, and it is sort of contrarian view, it's from Jim Palmer, who loved Jerry. But he said, you know, he did not necessarily, as an owner, have the greatest foresight. Look at the period of the late 70s, right before he sold the team. That's the period when baseball changes, free agency comes in, big money is starting to creep in. That's the first time. You got free agent contracts, you got Reggie for sale. You know, you got people, Eddie suddenly making.
And you had a great baseball team. And you had a football team that pissed everybody off in 70. I mean, I was 5 years old, 73, 74. Yeah. My dad was buying Chargers stuff from, you know, because he was so pissed about the Unitas thing that the Orioles were, they had won. They, you know, they several times. They were all of that in 75, 6, 7, 8, and couldn't sell enough tickets. And as a kid reading the papers who wanted to be John Stedman, as you well know, the portrayal of all of it was the big bad boogeyman in New York. It wasn't come out and support the team. I think that started in 79 with Oriole Magic, which was if you want the team to be better, you have to come out and give us a little bit of your money, which is what Mr. Rubenstein's going to have to do here. It's going to be more than a little bit of money too. But the money part of it is fascinating to me from Hofberger because he never really figured out how to make money on it.
He didn't figure out how to make money and he didn't. I mean, Palmer told me he didn't. He was a great guy, great owner, didn't necessarily have foresight on where baseball was going. I mean, you watched that, you know, the departure of some guys in the mid-70s, the late-70s, the early-80s, and the Orioles went from, they had already, the people, that last generation that wound up winning the World Series in 1983, they were already in place. The whole thing, DeCense and Dower, and, you know, Eddie had been drafted, and, you know, there's just, you know, Al Bumbrey, there were tons of them. So there, but yet that was starting to dry up. And so it became sort of a more free agent and put your team together that way and start piecing your team together. And you had to spend some money to do that. And it was the end of the Oriole way. It was the end of the Oriole way.
Cashman went to the Mets at that point, right?
Yeah. And you could, you know, it was hard to foresee it, but that's what happened was Baltimore did not necessarily, the franchise did not necessarily adjust that well to the beginning of free agency. And the fact that they had to throw a bunch of money, they didn't have a bunch of money. You know, Reggie, Earl Weaver and other people said, Reggie could have stayed. Reggie, they could have stepped up and paid money. Reggie would have stayed here and they could have had Reggie Jackson.
And that would have taken selling tickets after that to pay.
Yeah, like, literally. Could easily have happened. Reggie liked Baltimore. You know, he was fine. So, you know, it would have been that would have been really interesting. So but they didn't see that coming. And so that to me was that's the period of time when baseball was changing in a fundamental way, never to go back to the old way. And the Orioles, I think, did not, even though they won a World Series in 1983, they did not come out on the right side of it because it took them a long time to sort of adjust to the fact that, you know, it was more market driven and you had to spend some money.
Plan A and Plan B, free agency. I remember trying to figure all that out. It was like alphabet soup when I was 11 years old. John Eisenberger is our guest. He's providing great clarity, as he always does on all things Orioles baseball. I even got the Ravens with you, and you covered a couple of Ravens rings yourself, and like all of that. The Orioles have become a real front and center thing in every conversation I'm in. I'm sure that will change when Lamar and Mahomes walk out on the field in a couple of weeks, but the temperature for all of this and this rebuild and rebirth of Oriole baseball, I think you and I believed, at least over our breakfast at Panera 100 years ago, that at some point Peter would die, sell off, the kids would run, you know, what would happen, what's going to happen to the franchise. Where are you on this settling in of this Rubenstein thing and then paying the check last week and now bringing in Katy Griggs? I mean, they're doing what Major League Baseball is telling them to do based on what I can see. But this rebirth of this that's allowed your Substack and your bird tapes to be interesting to people, there really is something here that a lot of places don't have, which is this incredible rich heritage of things that bring people back generationally that would care what Ken Singleton or Harry Dalton would have to say, but also trying to build what's really here on a night by night basis and make it great again.
Yeah. Where I am is, I mean, it's a very exciting time for them. It's still a honeymoon. I love everything that Rubenstein's doing. And I think the most important thing, and we'll see where this goes, the most important thing out of it all, I do believe, and he hasn't said, I think he's really wants to do right by the city where he grew up. I think that's it. He wants to win a World Series for Baltimore. I do believe that. I mean, the guy's got a ton of money. He could have done any, and he's done a number of things philanthropically. And I think this is, in some regards, a piece of that. It's a high profile piece of that. It's not necessarily the biggest money piece of it, of what he does. But I think it's part of it. So I think that bodes well in the long run. But we are definitely still in the honeymoon. I mean, there's a lot of hurdles to clear. He's got a team to run now, and he's got all these young players. And I think it would be, for all the hats and the dancing on the dugout, it would be nice to sign somebody and show that measure. I mean, he's already shown with some of these trade deadline acquisitions, he's going to pick up contracts for next year for like Zach Eflin, the pitcher, and some guys. That's already a huge change from the huge change night and day from the way this team has operated for the last 20 years. So that it bodes well. But nonetheless, the guys that are here that are the cornerstones, whether, you know, probably Rutschman would be the first one. It sure would be a great signal that would just show the fans that this is the road we're going down now. We got money, we got players, we're going to keep them. I think that would be a nice thing to show to the fans.
Well, the measurement of the Boris guys isn't fair. Holding him responsible for signing, or anyone in the Orioles organization for signing a Boris guy who's not going to sign, because that's not the way he does business. It's not what he believes in. I think that's difficult. And that's difficult. Yeah, Westberg's hurt right now, but Henderson and Westberg are also is's. They're not might be's.
Right. So we'll see where it all goes. And they got other young guys coming. And it's a very interesting time. And they'll reach a point where they are going to have to spend some money to keep some of these players here. And I look forward to seeing how all that breaks down. As long as they continue to pump, it goes back to the era we were talking about before. As long as they continue to draft well, develop guys, and have players that other teams find desirable for trade, they're going to be pretty good. I think we're looking at a long period here where they're going to be a winning team. And that's good. I mean, it's certainly payback for a number of years of frustration. And I think it's just fun going forward.
Just staying on topic for the team and the trade deadline and the relief pitching and Eflin and Rogers and what they've done. I started doing the math on this. Once Westberg got hurt, Mateo got hurt. They've turned over a third of the roster in 2 weeks.
Eight guys. It was eight guys out of 26 on the roster the day when all the dust cleared. Eight out of 26. I don't remember a trade up. They really did remake the team in a lot of
respects.
And I
don't know if that's good or I don't know. Yeah. I mean, we were all complaining about the bullpen, and they clearly didn't have enough. And I mean, it's not often that you lose three starters and your firemen all within 11 months of each other to arm surgeries, and you're expected to somehow win 102 games because you won 101 last year.
Yeah.
And they were running away and hiding from the Yankees for a minute when the Yankees were struggling. I mean, they're a struggling baseball team as you and I speak here right now, about to go through the American League East on the road, and the sort of bad teams that have thrown in the hat a little bit. I'm trying to see them get well, but also what are they? Because I think they're a completely different team than they thought they were going to be in May when he had that press conference and said, I have six starters all of a sudden, when Means and Bradish were around and Wells was still a maybe. All of that's gone away now. I like the acquisitions. I just think it's sort of akin to Purple Rain 2 when Harbaugh came in week 14 and said, I'm firing the offensive coordinator. You're what?
Yeah.
You know, it's August. Right. You're remaking your team, you know? But
yeah.
If it could all work out.
It could work out. Certainly the Eflin hire, that was really good. That gives them a number three starter that they could put in a playoff game, which was that was really important that they find somebody to do that because they did not have that. And the bullpen makeover, I wasn't super satisfied with it. I was never super satisfied with the Kimbrel signing to begin with. And that's sort of playing out all along, I have to say, as I wasn't sure that he was there anymore. And he's a great pitcher, maybe a Hall of Fame pitcher at the end of his career, and doesn't have the command that he used to. That's clear. I don't know that you're going to put the ninth inning of a must-win playoff game, you know, I don't know that the city can handle that.
Well, the Phillies fans, you know, they had their fill last year of that, right?
Yeah. So we'll see. Maybe they'll ask the manager to be smart and mix and match. And you might occasionally see Ciano Perez out there in a really important game. And it's like, you know, oh my God, you know, I hope we get through this. So it'll be interesting. But there are a lot of pieces. And I think one thing very specifically that they did was last year in the playoffs, the Rangers just lined up lefty, 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 and the Orioles went down in a hurry. And this year, they were again had a terrible record against left-handed pitchers. And so they tried to make themselves better. And he gets some right-handed bats in here. And, you know, I don't know whether the guy from Chicago, Jimenez, he's off to a nice start. He wasn't hitting in Chicago. They were thrilled to see him leave, but he's got a lot more protection here. It's a much better team. And he can't hit. He's a hitter. And let's see if he can do that. And they're just trying to be better against left-handed pitching so they don't just get shut down like they did last year. So I understand that piece of it. And we'll see whether it works.
Yeah, we didn't talk about right-handed bats at all before the trading deadline. And then it's like I say to Luke all the time, people would call for years, what's Ozzie going to do on draft day? You see on draft day exactly what their intentions are. You see on trading deadline how Mike Elias felt about the bullpen, how he felt about the third starter, how he felt about the fourth starter, how he felt about an opening day starter next year, knowing that Corbin Burns is, I don't know, signable, unsignable. That's going to be the big thing in the offseason as to whether he wins three games in the World Series and they win a championship, or no matter how it turns out, next year is going to be different than this year, which makes it feel like every year is an important year to load up when you have healthy players to be able to do that. John Eisenberg is our guest here. I want to turn it back to your tapes and where you are on that to shed some light on what's been popular, because you start to see the clicks, you start to get the feedback of, oh my God, I learned that. What have been your favorite pieces that you've unearthed that weren't a part of the book that people are feeding back to you when they come to your Substack and listen to these great conversations of Oriole lore?
Well, I am seeing the clicks, and I will say this, my community is growing dramatically in the last 6 weeks to 2 months. So the things that I've put up more recently are performing better than some of the things I put up at the beginning when I was just getting started and trying to get attention. And, you know, that's where Boot Powell was and some Cal. And so I think I'm probably going to repurpose those and put them up again to let people know that they're there. The best performing.
I think you should put Cal up on September 6th. I'm just saying.
Yeah,
that's
a good idea.
And September 6th is the morning after the Ravens will be 1-0.
We'll see.
Boy, man, you know, it's high stakes. I'll get the football at the end. I'm saving that like Led Zeppelin and Stairway to Heaven. But but it is exciting, right?
Yeah. So my best performing piece, Eddie Murray.
Okay.
Eddie Murray.
Well, he didn't talk
one.
A lot, dude.
He didn't talk a lot. People had never heard his voice. They hadn't heard his voice. So I put it up immediately. Just watched the thing spike. I was like, wow, look at this. I just sat there and refreshed and watched it. I was like, look at this. People want to hear this. Do I have any others? Do I have any others that, you know, are sort of slightly mysterious? Because that performed extremely well.
I think I tell you this Eddie Murray story because, you know, I grew up, I was thinking about this. Eddie, just like the echoes of my mind, you know, on my deathbed, that'll be my thoughts of baseball will be the summer of 79 and hearing that echo underneath Memorial Stadium. And I grew up a kid, you know, collecting baseball cards, like all of that. I liked baseball. So my favorite players weren't Oriole players. They were Sisto Lescano, as you well know, you know? So like, I liked all of baseball. And I loved the Orioles and I loved Eddie and I rooted for Eddie and all that. But then I got into the media when I was 15. I met you when I was 16, maybe 85, 86. And Eddie was disgruntled. Clearly race was a part of this, the Stan Charles show, how he felt about Ken Rosenthal. Lusig tells this story of Eddie pinning Jr., as we would call Ken Rosenthal, up against the wall because of something Lusig a cartoon Rasig drew in the paper. I was working at the paper, and we're all trying to navigate through all this. And my Eddie thing was in 19, I want to say it was maybe 98, 99. I'm on the radio almost a decade at that time. We're setting up at spring training. They're training in Fort Lauderdale. It's before Angelo's threw me. It's when we're trying to still promote the baseball team. And we were down there for a week or two. The station existed, so it was probably 98, 99. And it was very early spring training. We would go down there in February before there were games to get to have access, talk to Messina, talk to these players and all of that. And I'm going to go down. There's like Valentine's Day you go down there. And it's February the 20-something. It's, you know how chilly it can be in Florida. It's 52 degrees in the morning in a February morning. And I'm walking back out onto that backfield. We did live radio at 6 in the morning because I had a radio station. So we're there at 5:30 in the morning. And I swear to you, at 6:21 in the morning, I saw Eddie Murray with a cup of coffee and a Fungo bat walk out with kids. Kids in those orange jerseys that were number 64, number 68, number 71. The sun's just coming up. It's cold. You can almost see your breath in Florida. And Eddie Murray's out there at 6 o'clock in the morning hitting Fungo. He's 3 years removed from playing. He was still 42, 43, you know? And he's out there, and I'm thinking, man, I never talked to that guy. All everybody ever did was dog that guy. That guy loves baseball. And that guy's out here hitting Fungos to a bunch of kids. And he's a millionaire. And didn't he be doing that this morning? And I thought differently of him. And I've never had an interaction other than taking a picture with Eddie Murray. Because I'm a media member, I felt like he would never talk to me.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say, it's so funny that the best performing interview is my one with Eddie. That's the only one-on-one conversation I've ever had with Eddie.
Ever.
I've been here 40 years.
How did he agree to it? And give me, because you were at his locker hundreds of times, right, at the end of his career, right?
Oh, all the time. And yeah, he just wouldn't talk. And it was, I don't know, I set it up. He was managing an Arizona Fall League team. It was in Arizona in a dugout before an Arizona Fall League game in 1999. He was managing a team. So I went through the team. And
this is the era I'm talking about with the Fungos. He was trying to be a coach. Okay.
He was trying. And so, you know, the person for the team or the league or whatever said, Eddie will be there at 4:30. And I said, oh, okay, great. So I went out to Arizona. I interviewed Frank, who was running the Arizona Fall League. And I interviewed Harry Dalton, who lived in the mountains outside Phoenix. So I had interviews, and then I go to Eddie. And I never spoke to him setting it up. I wasn't sure he'd show up. So 4:30, it's quiet stadium. And he comes around the corner and, you know, he just looks at me and he goes, now, what are you doing? And, you know, it was not kind. And so, but then, you know, I don't know what he thought. I talked him off the ledge. I said, look, Eddie, you know, whatever's gone on before, here's what I'm doing. I've gone around. I've talked to all your teammates. I've talked to everybody. If they're still alive, I've talked to them. And I want to talk to you about what made the Orioles good and bad, basically. And he kind of looked out onto the field, you know, and he says, okay, what you got? And so we didn't talk that long, but it was like 30 minutes. And he warmed up. I'm re-listening to it all these years later. He warmed up. He did say at one point, he confided a little bit. It was time to go. He said, you guys had done a number on me. And
feel like that's true? I didn't, as a kid here, I never felt like that was true. And I never.
Well, if you listen to the interview, what he does talk about the media, you know what he spends a lot more time talking about? What really upset him was when the owner criticized him. Edward Bennett Williams criticized him in 86, said a lack of extra base hits is he can't field, it's hurting the team, blah, blah, blah. That's what got him mad. The media stuff gets a lot of attention because the media gets attention. But really what upset him was the owner of the team criticizing him. He said, that was just something I felt like I didn't need to put up with. And so that's where it all went south. And that's the biggest problem in the Eddie Murray history here, the first chapter.
Dude, you just taught me something. I've known you 40 years. You've known this information 40 years. You know, like I never really knew the crux of it because I felt like I thought it might have just been the fans and overt racism in the Hank Aaron way.
I'm sure that was part of it. I'm sure it was part of it too. Let's not undersell that. I'm sure that was part of it. But I have no doubt coming away from that interview What really burned him was the owner. That's what burned him. You know, there. That's what drove him crazy. How can this happen? You know, I'm Eddie Murray. Why? I mean, I'm the best player on the team. How am I being criticized? And so I don't know. That's what it was.
We all have sensitivities, don't we? John Eisenberg has sensitivities to poor grammar and typos and all of that good stuff. Tell everybody where to follow you. I mean, just give me the Substack thing again so people can find that. But you're also doing great work, and you're signing books sometimes, and you've authored some great books. And I'm sure once this thing is over with, there's going to be a orange rain, or I don't know what you're going to call it. But
yeah, I don't know.
This is an interesting story to tell if this team were to win a World Series.
Yeah. I don't know where it's going, and I'm just doing it. Birdtapes.substack.com on the Substack platform. It's a subscription model. You can have a free subscription. You can have a paid subscription. And it's, as I said, the community growing a lot and as the word gets out. So that's gratifying and fun. You know, a lot of people are paying attention.
Good. Well, when I wrote Peter Principles, people like to know these stories and history. My Peter Principles thing was just literally all of the journalism that had been done around Peter from the time he bought it until, you know, such point where he stopped sort of operating it. And I think there is a fascination for anyone that's connected to Adley Rutschman or Gunnar Henderson, or, you know, they have little kids that want Gunnar Henderson's hair at this point, that there is an incredible chronicling and an accurate and rich history of why so many people love the Orioles. So off baseball, John, last thing for you, football, got to give it to you. Offensive line, where we are, Lamar's place in the world, Derrick Henry. They're stacked. They're expected to win. But as I pointed out, boy, I don't know that there's ever been a game like this where you go on the road to, you know, to see Kansas. They didn't do any of this in the New England era. A little bit with Peyton Manning out in Denver when Angelos threw him out after they had the parade. But this is as big a game as there is in the league. And these two players, this is fun. This gets me excited a month ahead of time. It really does.
That's a great game. It'll be fun. I wouldn't put too much emphasis on it. If I recall correctly, Kansas City opened the season last year at
Detroit
home
lost.
On Thursday night and lost the game and won the Super Bowl. So, you know, I wouldn't say that it's the most important thing, but it's very interesting. Ravens usually, they're pretty good on the road. Under Harbaugh, he has them in the right place mentally usually to go on the road for a big game and be a tough out. So we'll see. I think the team will be good. That's a very tough game. That's going to be a tough one to win. Looks to me like a good team. A really good team. I'm not too worried about the offensive line. They got a bunch of guys that they've drafted and they've worked on the last few years. And I do have a lot of faith in the offensive line coach, Joe D'Alessandro. He's one of the best coaches in that building. And he is just tireless. And you will see him out there. Talk about Eddie Murray hitting fungos. You will see him out there working well in the footwork of some big hulking guy who isn't going to play this year, but in 2 years might. And he's been at that for a while with some of these big Falele and some of these guys. And I think they'll probably be able to put people out there that can do the job. And knowing that it sure helps to have Ronnie Stanley, who looks healthy and better on the left side, and Linderbaum in center, that's helpful to have some anchors. I'm not that worried about the offensive line. I'll be interested to see. They had a really, really, really good defensive coordinator here. And Zach Orr, who I like a lot, has got big shoes to fill. Mike McDonald, to me, was a star. And it's no surprise that he is immediately a head coach somewhere else. Very tough to fill that guy because they had a great defense last year. He had a lot to do with that. And so they got plenty of players on that side of the ball, but Roquan Smith and Hamilton and all those guys. But when Gary Kubiak was here as offensive coordinator a decade ago, he's kind of a ringer. He's a head coach. He's just, dropping down for a year. Okay, I'll run your offense. You know, they should have been in the Super Bowl that year. Blew the playoff game up in New England. I felt that way a little bit about Mike McDonald. I said, and he's young, and we'll see how he is as a head coach. But just a real, strong, strong coach. So that's a loss. That's the biggest loss to me that they had in the offseason. So we'll see how that goes on that side of the ball.
Well, I don't hear a lot of people talking about that. And as far as a big loss, but I know it's a different room that plays will be called differently. They got a lot of leadership and Tiger over there with Roquan Smith as well. And and Hamilton's just become just a great football player, right? Like,
just a great football player.
And you know, we go back to their talent evaluation and where they are. I'd like to think that if they think they're okay on the offensive line, who am I to question that? But until I see it, and jettisoning in Zeitler and Moses and the health of Stanley and where they are with the kid from Washington and where Linderbaum is, very good. I just, there's a lot riding on it. So I would like to think that they have more confidence than any of us out here have.
I think that's a good way to put it. I do. I don't see them worrying a whole lot. Doesn't sound like it. So that's not to say that it's going to be, you know, the best offensive line in the league. But they got a lot of young guys, and they're pretty good at coaching those guys up at that position. So I think it will not just be a red flag that brings the season down.
Look, dude, the Cardinals or the Seahawks cut some guard who looks like Zeitler. They would let you know on August 30th how they feel if they go and sign a veteran, right? Like they show their hand. They do. By the end of the month, they'll show whether they like these guys or whether they don't. And much like other training camps, there'll be a couple guys they think they like now that they don't like at the end of the month.
Yeah, and they may well do it. They're not afraid, obviously, in today's NFL. You can't be afraid to cut ties. You can't be romantic. You cannot be romantic. Yeah, you know, you got to win the next game. So, yeah, they'll bring in somebody. And who was the guard last year? John Simpson?
Yeah,
right?
Everybody says,
they let him go. People said, well, you know where they found him? They found him, like, you know, out on the scrap heap somewhere. So they can do that.
John Eisenberg, none of his stuff's out on a scrap heap. He's unearthing the Bird tapes out of Substack. You can follow him out on the interwebs as well. What's coming down the pike? Give me a couple of ball players you have not released yet. You released Paul Blair yet?
Yes, I released Paul Blair. As
Terry
I said,
Crowley? You released Terry Crowley yet?
I don't have Terry.
Oh, okay.
I do not have Terry. I do have Milt Pappas. Milt Pappas coming, very interesting. I did talk about who performed. I put Steve Barber up over a couple of weeks. I had a really long. I went all the way to Vegas to interview him, so I got a lot of on tape with him. Just a, you know, what a deal. You know, talking about a guy in the 50s and early 60s, and he was rough and profane and funny, and people seemed to like it. So I've got Pappas, who was the, you know, he and Barber and Pappas hated each other. It's very evident in the interviews. So now we'll get Pappas' side of the story. You know, traded for Frank Robinson, incredibly bitter about it, incredibly bitter. How many years later was it? 34 years later when I interviewed him, just incredible. And so that one's coming. That's the next player. So and then I'll keep rolling. I got I have to digitize a new crew. So I haven't decided. Davey Johnson coming down the pipe.
Oh.
And so, and of course, I also have Peter Angelos coming down the pike, 2 hours. And I don't know when I'm going to do that one. I haven't digitized it yet, but it'll come sometime this fall.
What was your conversation with him about or like? I mean,
it was good.
About the history of the team or about where he stood in 99, owning the team?
Where he stood in 99 and what people were mad at him about. And he agreed to do it. We went to, he bought a bottle of wine. We had lunch at Little Italy. The tape recorder ran. And it was
Boccaccio. Was this a Boccaccio?
Yeah. And so I'm going to have to listen back to it. It'll be, I haven't listened in a long time.
That's the day I become a subscriber, Eisenberg.
Okay.
You can go listen to my 2 hours of them over highballs at the barn. And it was something. Yeah. My chat with him was in March of 98. It was right after he fired John Miller. He didn't bleed enough orange and black. So, like, got him about a year later. And at that point, I guess he had fired Regan. I'm just going through all the names. Davey had left because Davey was still here. So it was 97. It was March of 97 that I interviewed him, not 98. So it was, he was feeling real strong. He was talking Chris Widger trades and like all of that. I wonder in 99 what you got. So I'm looking forward to that.
I've forgotten some of it. So I look forward to hearing it myself, and I will put it up.
Hope you talked a little Washington will never have a baseball team. You know, it's all that's going on. John Eisenberg's here. The Orioles are under new ownership, but still owned by the people here and Orioles fans. It's going to be a great run-up. If you want to enjoy it a little bit more, enjoy the history of Oriole baseball. No one tells it better than John Eisenberg through the mouths and ears and storytellers of the people who live the game. By the way, I had a young man on in Wisconsin who wrote a book on Harry Dalton recently.
Yeah, Lee Cluck.
Well. Lee Cluck. Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned race in the American League and National League. I had John, the other Eisenberg on, the great Jerry Eisenberg on, wrote a book on Larry Doby. So it's been a great summer to talk about baseball and talk about all this. I'm glad your bird tapes are doing well, John. Appreciate it.
Great. Appreciate it. Thanks
I'm
for having me
I'm glad you found
on.
the archives there as well. Nothing better than a rich archive. John Eisenberg, longtime columnist at Ravens.com as well at the Baltimore Sun. I am Nestor. We are WNSD. AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. We never stop talking Baltimore positive.